Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. I'm Chris Noyce and this is the podcast for everything to do with the convenience sector and the issues facing local shops. On this episode of the podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by the Managing Director of Portland Fuel, James Spencer. James is an expert on the global fuel market and a frequent contributor to television and radio debates on the topic. James, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
No problem.
As of recording, we at ACS are gearing up now for the launch of our 2019 forecourt report. So this episode will not only talk about some of the opportunities and challenges in the fuel and forecourt market at the moment, but also give a bit of a sneak peek into some of the results from the report ahead of release. And hopefully you'll find this useful, especially if you're listening to this on the way to the ACS forecourt study tour ahead of launch. Hopefully pass a bit of time on the train or in the car. Now, James, a quick bit of LinkedIn stalking tells me that you've been MD of Portland for just over 10 years. And that frames my first question, really. So how much has the forecourt and fuel sectors changed over that period of time?
Well, I mean, globally, the oil industry has changed quite considerably with the developments of shale oil, particularly, and the kind of squeezing out increasingly of OPEC supplies in favour of the US. In terms of the domestic forecourt sector, of course, there's been tremendous developments in terms of ownership and the retraction of the oil majors and the growth of the what you might call the super independents, the likes of Euro Garages and MRH, etc. And MFG, I think they're now merged, if I'm correct there. MFG have bought out Malthurst, I think, Malthouse. So in terms of the ownership, there's been quite considerable changes. I think in terms of fundamentally what the products being sold, there's a higher content of biofuels. That was kind of started 10 years ago in terms of that journey. Forecourts tend to look a lot better than they used to, and there are fewer of them. So I suppose all things together, it's quite different. But I would say it's more of a, not a transformation, just a general evolution.
Yeah, and one of the things we talk about a lot when it comes to convenience as a whole is the importance of investment. And when we survey forecourts specifically, they typically invest more per quarter in their shop than other retailers. So where do you see this investment going? Do you think forecourts are playing catch up to the rest of the sector, or do you think there are some areas where they're almost leading the rest of the sector in terms of what they're investing in?
Well, I suppose you can go kind of anecdotally in terms of your own personal experiences going to local forecourts, and I've been on an excellent ACS forecourt study, or where we went around various forecourts. And I think the first thing to say is that the investment is paying off, because forecourts are, you know, in terms of the way they look, the terms of the feel, and how welcoming they are for customers, you know, they are very, very different. So, you know, the thought that 10 years ago, or perhaps more relevantly 20 years ago, because I would maintain that 10 years ago these trends had started, but the thought that you'd have a farm shop and a petrol station shop 20 years ago, I mean, you'd be sanctioned for thinking such a daft thing. So, you know, I think the investment has paid off. I think it's very obvious that they've invested more in the shop at end, but I don't think that's because the fuel side and the fuel retailing side doesn't receive investment. I think fundamentally we're still talking about a liquid fuel. A lot of the big garages, they take driver control deliveries, so what you call DCD deliveries. So a lot of the fuel delivery in is done by the tanker companies and the fuel suppliers. So there's kind of not too much change in terms of the fuel retailing. So all of the money really, or the visible money at least, I don't run a petrol station, so I'd have to surmise that the visible money has gone into the store.
Sure.
And I think personally, I think that's paying dividends, because these places that you see now are, you know, they're very good places to go and shop.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I was in a forecourt just the other day in Guildford, recently opened by a nicer retailer, and it's a bit of an Aladdin's cave. Actually, when you go in, it from the outside looks like a reasonably small forecourt, but it goes back. It must be sort of 4,000 or 5,000 square feet. It's got fantastic bakery, butchery sections, really huge wine section, lots of alcohol, lots of free from, lots of vegan options. It's one of those real eye-opening stores that just redefines what a forecourt looks like.
And I think that's kind of investment has gone in all kind of ways. So obviously investment on a kind of asset basis has gone into new freezers and new lighting and flooring systems and all the rest of it, heating or whatever, insulation, but a lot of investment has gone into careful design. So when you have a desire to invest in these shops, what you do is you end up taking advice from consultants, you take advice from marketeers, you take advice from people who know retail, such that a petrol station is no longer a petrol station, really. It's a retail outlet. And so a lot of the investment has just gone into clever use of space. So this whole Aladdin's Cave, it's quite remarkable. When you go into some smaller sites and you actually see the range of stuff they have, I mean, it's a miracle. It's a miracle of planning. And, you know, again, I can't comment on how fast these products shift, but I would say you make it, you know, you make the experience good, you put as many product lines as you can get in a well-designed and crafted space, and it pays dividends.
Yeah, and so we just talked about the fuel sector still being predominantly liquid fuel. One of the things that grabs a lot of the headlines at the moment is around electric charging. Now, the Forecourt report talks about figures that say that we've got now over 200,000 plug-in cars on the roads now. Do you think Forecourt's are doing enough to cater to that market, especially given that most charging points as we stand are elsewhere?
Well, first answer to your question, are they doing enough? I think they probably are doing enough, because I think actually this is a very big problem for fuel retailers.
Sure.
I know there's always an opportunity and there will be opportunities, but fundamentally you are talking about a different way of fueling your transport, fueling your car. If I have a car today, I do not have the option of filling that up at my home.
Right.
And I do not have the option of filling that car up in a public car park or a train station car park or anywhere else that I find a charging point on the roadside. So to a certain extent, the petrol retailers had a monopoly on where you can fuel. And of course, that developed from the early days of fire safety and all the rest of it. So the biggest number one competition they have is they are now competing with other places where I can fuel my car. So, yeah. Of course, that means that the retail offering has to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Because if you are literally just relying on fuel, then you probably do have a problem if this transition to electric, which of course will take time, but I think with passenger cars, it will take less time than most people are thinking. I have said for a long time, and I said it at the ACS conference in the King Power Stadium in Leicester, that the transition to electrical cars is really getting very close to hitting a tipping point. And my prediction, from what it's worth, is in 2025, the majority of cars produced, that's not on the road, but the majority of cars produced will be electric. So that's quite a big sea change. So this is going to present a big problem for petrol retailers.
And do you think that will come with further innovation in terms of charging and how fast that is? Because we hear a lot about one of the big problems. So the retailer I was with, they have four or five parking spaces and only four lines of pumps. And so they were saying the big problem is they looked at electric charging as a thing, but they're saying for someone who potentially is going to be 45 minutes in a space, that's a big problem for them, because, you know, they just can't have that space for that long.
Massive problem. And you know, again, I mean, you know, everybody knows, anybody who runs a petrol retail garage knows that this is it's a unit cost, it's a margin game, it's all about getting your volumes through, because, you know, you've got these high costs to pay off, and so you need more volume. And if you've got four cars taking up four charging units for 45 minutes, well, you know, it's incomparable compared to how many cars you can get through, four separate petrol pumps in 45 minutes. So there's so many kind of angles to this. So number one, I think the chargers are going to play catch up, because my other point about electric cars has always been that this is not driven by a rational desire per se to own an electric car. It is driven by a desire to be cool, and that desire is, I want to own an electric car.
Yeah.
And that's particularly true with the next generation of car owners. I do not buy the idea that younger people will not be interested in mobility and will not be interested in having their own cars. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, car sharing and you're not going to own a car. I don't believe that's the case. I think people will want their own cars.
Yeah, I can't see a scenario where people are going to be happy just renting cars?
I mean, well, I think there's a push and a pull. I think the pull is I believe that consumers want their own mobility, and I think the push is that the likes of Ford and General Motors and Mercedes are just not going to allow it to happen.
Yeah.
If you have a business model that churns out 350,000 cars a year, whether they're electric or petrol, you still want to churn out 350,000 cars a year.
Yeah, of course.
The figure might be 2 million. I'm not an expert in automotive production, but so I think people will own their own cars. But I do believe they want them to be electric. So I think the charging and the infrastructure, and to a certain extent the base load that's going through the national grid, all of those areas are going to play catch up. And I can easily see a scenario where the gap between what's available on the roads and the desire for electric cars is so large that in Western democracies, there is going to be huge funding and subsidy to get these electricity points in.
Sure.
And massive pressure placed on the big six as is now, and whether it'll be a big four in 10 years or whether it'll be a big 10 in 10 years, massive pressure will be put on the utility companies to make sure the base load is ready and the power generation is ready. And actually, they are well on with that.
Yeah.
You know, these guys are not daft. They know this is coming. They are upgrading for an electric mobility future. So I think probably, I have no insight into this, but I believe funding will be made available simply because there's going to be a gap. And I suspect that is where the petrol retailers or the electricity retailers, as they may well become, will need to be very much ahead of the game in getting these petrol stations ready so that they can compete with all the other areas that electric cars can charge.
Sure. And I guess it's a bit of a tension in forecourts at the moment between this idea of setting forecourts up so that people can stay for longer, and we talked about electric charging, the amount of time that takes, and setting up the shop, and the forecourt report talks about food to go and getting people in and charging points in the store for phones and that kind of thing so that people can dwell for longer. There's a tension between that and then the other side of things, which is the pay at pump, the apps that allow you to pay without even leaving the car. Do you see a market almost splitting in two between, I'm not talking necessarily about size here, because of course service stations are big and they're set out for this, but splitting in two in terms of mission between, you just have forecourts that are, even on one site maybe, you've got half the forecourt is almost the drive-through section, which is dedicated to people that just want to get in and out, and then you've got half a forecourt which is come in, fuel up, come and sit down, and then and you know spend some time with us.
Well, that will be the logical kind of route to take if you have the space. And that's kind of the big issue that a lot of the independents have is that they might want to do that, but they don't really have the space to split it out in that way. As you rightly say, service stations are naturally geared for this kind of people spending longer, and because when you stop at a service station, you are, by nature, you are stopping for a longer period of time.
Mm.
You know, however good the shop offering is in a independent petrol retailer or an independent forecourt, you know, you still don't get many people who actively want to spend 25 minutes there. I mean, the farm shop might be good and the coffee might be good, but, you know, you're still fundamentally wanting to stop to fill up and, great, I can pick up this and I can pick up that, but I don't want to wait another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So the splitting of the product is a way of countering that. But you are still talking about getting people to come in, and even if they don't get out of the car and they just, you know, they sit there and they charge up, it's still 20 minutes, 25 minutes, which most people in a busy world would say, really not on for that. I'd rather just leave it at the train station or the, you know, on my drive or whatever and charge it then. And so they will time their charging that suits them. So you may end up with a situation where the kind of quick fire charges that are available on a petrol forecourt become a bit of an emergency stop.
Okay. Sort of distress.
Distress purchase. Yeah. Now that is not necessarily a bad thing, because of course, nobody would necessarily say that you want to take advantage of that. But equally, a distress purchase tends to be higher margins than a day-to-day purchase. So it may well be that this idea of electricity only is potentially, you know, it is very much for people who absolutely need it, and they're going to have to pay a premium for that. All roads, of course, lead back to anybody who solely sells fuel and doesn't have another offering is going to struggle.
Yeah. And the only... And that's sort of my next question, really, in that as cars become more efficient, and we talked about electric charging and the pressures on competition between forecourts and, I guess, anywhere else on the grid, forecourt retailers have got to be a bit smarter about how they get people in at all, even onto the site. I remember an evening with Sabine Benoit, who's been on the podcast previously, who talked about the amount of times that people need to fill up their car when they're driving long journeys versus the amount of times they might need to use the bathroom. Mm. And obviously bathroom journeys are a lot higher, and that's why having great facilities in forecourts is really important. What have you seen forecourts doing to just get people on site now?
Well, I mean, I feel we're probably, this is the ACS, so it's the Association of Convenience Stores, so naturally the focus is on, is on the convenience side. I mean, there are, of course, things, as long as fuel is still fueling the vast majority of cars, there are, of course, things that fuel retailers can do to get people on, so the premium grades that are sold in terms of, the BP Ultimate and Shell V-Fuel, and I can't remember the other products, my apologies, and I'm not a champion of either Shell or BP.
Other products are available.
Other products are available, indeed. They do actually, if you actually look at the figures, they do attract a dedicated kind of consumer who does make their way to BP sites or Shell sites or supermarkets, again, being the cheapest. And I believe, with the pressure that we have now, environmental, there will be increasingly, they won't be zero carbon, but there will be increasingly lower carbon fuel options, mm-hmm. particularly on the diesel side. I think there are lots of things being done on low CO2 diesel, but also on petrol. And, if you look at Brazil has tremendously high amounts of ethanol in the petrol mix. They always have, because they've got a sugarcane industry which produces a waste which goes into ethanol, and so their cars have run on 25% ethanol for 50 years. There's nothing new about these things. So I think you're going to see a little bit of a attraction to fuel consumers, because we can get carried away. We are still talking about a transition that's going to take at least 10 years.
Sure.
And so the other thing I believe you may find is that you'll have a number of forecourts. So I can't see the number of forecourts massively shrinking or anything like the rates that they've shrunk in the past. But I could see a world where of the forecourts, only half of them have fuel.
Okay.
So half, the other half have obviously a convenience angle, but they have electricity chargers.
Yeah.
But the guys who want to stay in fuel will naturally migrate to, we're the fuel suppliers and we will look after fuel consumers. And then the other side is, well, we're just moving to a fully electric future. So I think that's maybe how the fueling side goes. I'm not an expert on the convenience side and the shopping side, but in terms of getting people in, one of the sites I saw, which I was very impressed by, again, it was dependent on space. And so I think that's the big issue for smaller operators. But this site had more than one offering, and by that I don't just mean it had a cafe, some chillers for meat and food and magazines. It had a laundry on site,
sure,
and
yeah.
It had a farm shop on site, and it had a deposit box for people picking up parcels and things.
Goods.
So,
yeah. We see a lot more of that. Things you wouldn't expect, like dry cleaning,
exactly,
pharmacy collections, all those sort of things that are making that forecourt into a bit more of a convenience store, a full shop.
And you
mentioned fuel grades just a moment ago as something that was changing. The eagle-eyed amongst you, and if you run a forecourt site, you will be well aware of this. Hopefully, we've had some fuel labelling changes over the last couple of months. Now everything petrol is labelled E5, diesel labelled B7. And this is, I guess, a precursor towards introduction of E10 in the UK. You mentioned about these markets changing. Do you think the UK forecourt sector is set up for the introduction of E10? And if, I guess, what sacrifices a forecourt retailer is going to have to make? Because at the moment, I look at forecourt pumps and I see four pumps. I see a premium grade and a standard grade on petrol and diesel. I don't see a lot of space for an extra grade E10 in addition to that.
No, and you've got to go on pure basic economics here. If my synopsis is correct and the government synopsis is correct, which is we are going to use less fuel year on year going forward, partly because of electrification, but also because of fuel efficiency. I mean, engines are so much more efficient than they were. Mm. And that's another reason why lots of people go to the loo a lot on long motorway journeys and don't fuel so much, is because their engines take them a lot further.
Sure.
And that is compounded if you have hybrids, for example, where you'd still need to fuel, but you've got half electric, or not, it rarely is half electric, as we know, as anybody's got a hybrid, it's rarely half electric, but there is an element that's electric. So in terms of the prognosis for fuel, it's going to decline. Right. And that doesn't mean it's going to disappear. It's still going to be very big and arguably massive. But on that basis, what independent retailer or oil major is going to invest in more pipework and more filtration systems and more pumps to ensure that they have six grades on offer rather than four?
When they're going to get
okay, so you know, and yeah, because sure. Anything that involves re-engineering involves civil engineering, which means digging up the site, which means lower footfall, etc., etc., etc. Now, if there is a clear kind of business reason that says, well, I want an extra grade in because, for example, environmentally conscious people will pay 10 pence a litre more for this low CO2 fuel, then there will be people who have the deep pockets to do this, or they have supportive banks to lend them the money to do this. They will say, fine, we're going to have a brand new fuel island. We're just going to bang it in and we're going to get payback because, you know, that's what people are willing to pay. It feels unlikely to me in probably the most competitive market, certainly the most competitive fuel market in Europe, but possibly one of the most competitive markets anywhere in the world is the British fuel retailing market.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So are we going to see more than four grades? No. And that means there has to be sacrifices made.
Okay.
And if I'm a petrol retailer, I'm going to say, well, I want to keep my premium grade fuel because it makes me a lot more money.
Yeah,
and that's
sure.
absolutely where they'll go. So they're going to want to keep one or two. So obviously you've got normally petrol and diesel. So you're kind of left with two alternatives after that. And I think the government, I think they did it for the right reasons, but not allowing E10, or, you know, at the end of the day, they were going for E10. Then it was pointed out that certain old cars, particularly petrol cars, couldn't run on E10, and therefore they didn't want to do that. So they stuck at E5. That's not going to be the case in, you know, very, very soon. That is not going to be the case.
Sure.
The government will mandate E10. To be clear, the fuel suppliers can do this. You know, E10, if you're going to blend E5, E7, E8.5, you can do E10. You know, the ethanol's coming into the UK, or it's been, well, it was being produced in the UK, but there's been a couple of guys who have gone by the wayside. But the point being is that if you can blend E5, you can blend E10.
Sure.
And ditto, you can blend B5, you can blend B10. So I can't see many retailers being able to offer more than four grades. So for me, it's going to be two premium grades and it's going to be two standard grades. And what the listeners can't hear is I'm doing the little speech marks thing with my fingers. The standard grade is going to be basically E10 and B10. So
right.
That's ethanol 10%, biodiesel 10%.
Yeah, it does feel like we're slightly isolated from the rest of this market. Because you go out to America and there's E85 out there, which is basically rocket fuel, and
Indeed. It
seems like there's quite a lot in the rest of the global market, and we seem to be a little bit stuck.
Well, there's two interesting kind of angles there. I mean, American market is fascinating, and we do a little bit of work in America, and this is certainly a very interesting retail market. We'll come back to that one, but fundamentally we're out of kilter. A terrible time to be talking about being out of kilter with Europe, because I suspect we're out of kilter with Europe in more ways than fuel.
The Brexit podcast is later this week.
Well, the B word can be banned, but certainly on mainland Europe, most countries have E10, and they've not gone for this kind of interim measure where you've kind of staggered it in staged kind of levels from E5, E7, E10, you know, they've just gone straight for E10. So we are out of kilter with Europe. And one thing we do know, whether we're in the European Union or not, the European fuels market is a completely integrated market.
Yep.
So I think E10 is a given. B10, there are few more issues with B10 around engine warranties. Ethanol is a very pure fuel. Ethanol really does no damage to petrol engines. I think the main issue is what you said there about E85. It's kind of potentially kind of rocket fuel. It actually rips off the rips off the insides of petrol engines because it's so high performing. Diesel, biodiesel at least, is a slightly different issue in that there's a lot of gumming, there's a lot of waxing. So there are more quality issues with B10, but none of them are insurmountable. So again, I don't think it's only a matter of time before that B10 comes in place, and as I say, they become the standard grades. I go just a quick one on the American market. American market is very interesting because, of course, although from the outside and certainly through perhaps slightly pejorative European eyes, we look at the Americans and we think they're, you know, there's a lot of climate change deniers and they're not particularly environmentally focused. But of course, because it's a massive market and because there are lots of people who are absolutely not those things, the Americans are way ahead in so many areas of clean fuel legislation.
Right, sure.
And that is...
Although we have just seen the stuff being cut out in California. Is it, they were planning it all?
Well, so that, I mean, that in itself is one of the reasons they're far ahead, is because each state actually has a great deal of authority to go ahead and do their own thing. So what we see is a kind of public pronouncement by the current administration in the White House. They will say ABC, but it doesn't mean that California needs to do ABC. Now, I know there is a dispute between, you know, the federal government and California, but each different state is able to mandate its own area. So if you have a particularly progressive state in environmental areas, you'll find that they do permit much higher non-fossil fuel percentages. They, of course, have a massive corn and wheat industry, all of which go into ethanol. So it's become a bit of a backbone, of a staple for Midwestern farmers in the States, which, of course, is, you know, that's most people would say that's a pretty good vote winner. So, you know, despite on the surface the Americans perhaps seemingly being less environmental than the Americans, it's probably worth flagging that the country with the fastest decrease in CO2 emissions in the world is the USA.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, they're not doing too badly, irrespective of what's said publicly. One final point in American forecourts, one of the reasons they're able to put in more than four grades, of course, is this fundamental point that Americans have. They have space.
Yeah.
So they have much bigger forecourts.
That always struck me. So been to America a couple of times. We work a lot with NACS over in the States, and their convenience model is pretty much dominated by forecourts with stores. And you're right, these are forecourts that don't have anything around them. They have pretty much free rein to increase the space they're on, whereas in the UK, I mean, we talk in the report about the number of forecourts that are isolated, and it is, you know, it's almost half of forecourts are isolated, but it's not like they're isolated on big plains with nothing around them. They are, you know, they are on the side of A roads, B roads, and there isn't that space to expand.
No sports clubs, primary schools, terraced housing, and the rest to worry about. So that does give them a bit of a freer hand. So
So my final question then, given that we started looking back 10 years and you've alluded to a couple of things that you think will be coming up in the future, if you were to go a decade or even a little bit further from now, what are your big predictions for the next 10 or even 20 years? And bear in mind, please feel free to be as mad as you like, because 20 years time, I'm not going to come and call you up on it.
I'm glad you won't. Well, I think the big one is what I've said. I mean, I just see the inevitability of electric cars is, I mean, I just cannot see anything stopping them now. If I'm right, 2025, the majority of cars coming off the production line are electric. In 10 years, you know, 2029, that would strike me, at least 50% of cars on the road be electric. So let's give or take, say, in 10 years' time, we have electric mobility for passenger cars.
Right.
I don't see that in trucks and buses. I think the payload issue with trucks and buses, the technology, the simple cost, you know, to give an idea of a comparison on a bus, you know, buses aren't cheap full stop, but a diesel bus, brand new diesel bus, Euro 6 engine, which is the kind of cleanest diesel engine you've got, probably about £150,000-£160,000. A electric bus is about £500,000.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that the price isn't going to come down as technology improves. Of course it will. That's the nature of markets, and that's why markets are great, because they do push down costs. However, you know, if you are a municipal bus company and you have to buy, let's say, 20 new buses a year, and you're working on a 10-year cycle, that means you've got 200 buses. You know, even if tomorrow you said, right, we're going to go electric from tomorrow, you've still running your fuel buses for another 10 years.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, the rollover is very different. So I don't see that kind of electric mobility existing for trucks and buses. Certainly don't see it for ships. I think ships are more likely to go to something like LNG, which is liquefied natural gas. I think that will be the way they go. I think.
And you mentioned about sites as well, and perhaps up to half of the sites just not selling fuel at all?
That would be, to me, there will be a bit of a fallout as more people need electrical cars. And I think some will take advantage of that and really focus on that market. Others will. And it's not a bad business model to say, actually, you know what, I'm just going to focus on old school fuel. Because one of the things that you will find is that as fuel for personal mobility decreases, that will have an impact on supply and demand, global balances on world oil markets. And so it will mean that there is more scope for margin. You will have volatility. Just because a product is going to decline in demand doesn't mean that that means its price is going to go down.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
It means that suppliers are going to look at this and say, you know what, I'm not going to spend millions of pounds on these massively complicated engineering projects to get it out the ground.
Yeah.
So, you know, supply and demand will move in their own kind of separate ways, which will cause, you know, pricing issues. And for most retailers, you know, a bit of price volatility is no bad thing. So I could see site splitting. I see any site that basically doesn't have a convenience offer is almost certainly going to disappear.
Yeah.
I cannot see them surviving. I guess a continuation of the fuel debate about the number of grades of fuel, whilst we may not have more than four on average, I think there will be an opportunity to sell really low CO2 fuels. But again, they will almost certainly just displace a less fashionable or a less usable fuel, so certain grades will disappear. It's difficult to know. Will the majors come back in? I guess for most independents, that's a very interesting debate. And I think to a certain extent they will. So when I started with BP, which was back in the early 90s, you know, the trend was for the oil majors to stop pulling out of downstream being the kind of consumer end, the refined products, and focusing all on upstream. Upstream being the product that you get out the ground, the crude oil, and that you trade on.
Yeah.
So all of the focus and the investment was exploration, oil exploration, getting out the ground, and why do we need these experts who can sell fuel in forecourts or sell fuel to truck companies or to ships or whatever? Let's just get engineers who get out the ground for the cheapest amount of cost, and we just put it on the market because it's easy. You don't need a marketing department or a sales department to sell crude oil. You get out the ground and people buy it at the market price.
Sure, yeah.
That has really come full circle now, and it's come full circle because people are beginning to agree. There's by no means consensus on this, but there are more and more people saying, well, oil fundamentally is in its final lap now.
Yeah.
As other power sources come on, so oil is going to be required less, and there is more money to be made back dealing with a consumer because of all the factors we've talked
of
for
course.
The last
20-25
minutes. So what I'm seeing with the BPs and the ExxonMobils of this world is a much greater renewed interest back in the downstream. So I guess one interesting angle 10 years from now might be the reappearance of, I mean, they've always had strong retail branding, but strong retail ownership rather than just a hands-off, let other people do the sites.
Yeah,
and
so
of course, when it comes to investment, that might be one of the reasons they come in, because let's not underestimate how expensive it's going to be to put in 20 electric charging points.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess what I take from this is we've seen real change in the forecourt market, like I say, over the last 20 years, but it's not like now this is a market that has reached a point where it's comfortable and is mature and is sort of steady. There is a lot of change to come, and I guess for retail and the convenience side of things, I think we're probably on the right side of that. That's really exciting for us. I guess I'm a little disappointed that we don't have any talk of flying cars. I thought that would have been really important for the 10-year discussion.
Well, we could talk about it, but I don't think it's going to happen.
It's very sensible, and that's all fine. Listen, I really appreciate joining me on the podcast. Thank you for sharing your insights with that. And please look out for James the next time he's on BBC Breakfast or similar, Five Live, Radio 4.
Or ACS.
Or an ACS event, yeah. So I'll just finish up by saying the Forecourt Report itself will be out to the public on Friday the 4th of October. You can download it on our website. And one final thing for me, the next big event we've got coming up is Heart of the Community, and that's our biggest political conference of the year. That's 15th of October in Westminster. This event is now overbooked, so congratulations if you managed to book in time. It's going to be a great event, and for those of you that aren't able to make it on the day, we're going to see if we can record some live episodes of the podcast that cover the panel sessions on crime, services and food. So really looking forward to that, and look out for those episodes. And that's it from me. As always, you can keep up to date with everything we've got going on by following us on Twitter at @ACS_local shops, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, on our website acs.org.uk, and of course make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get new episodes before everyone else.